This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the new Young People's Poet Laureate. In 2015, Jacqueline Woodson became the Young People's Poet Laureate, a title given every 2 years by the Poetry Foundation for outstanding achievement in poetry for children and adolescents. This year, the baton has been passed to Margarita Engel, who over the next 2 years will be promoting a love of poetry among young readers and also advising the Poetry Foundation on that mission. Margarita Engel is a novelist as well as a poet, and she joins me to read a few of her poems. Margarita, I read that you've been writing and reading poetry since you were a child, which is pretty unusual, actually. So how did that happen? Did you have great teachers or literary parents? How did you get into poetry?
My mother read to me a lot, and of course, she's from Cuba, and she loved José Martí, so she would also recite poems in Spanish, and poetry was like a magnet for me. Travel books were also magnets for me, and so through my lifetime, I've kind of combined my love of verse with love of travel stories and exploring the world. And in particular, exploring my mother's home country of Cuba.
Yeah, we're going to get into that right away because I'd like you to read the opening poem from your book, The Lightning Dreamer, Cuba's Greatest Abolitionist. It's in the voice of Tula, the nickname of Gertrudis Gómez de
Gertrudis Gómez de Avellaneda, who would probably be a lot more famous to English language readers if her name was easier to pronounce. Luckily, she did have a nickname, Tula.
So Tula's her nickname, which is so much easier for us.
It does help.
Can you read that poem for us?
Yes. And this is in the voice of Tula. Books are door-shaped. Books are door-shaped portals, carrying me across oceans and centuries, helping me feel less alone. But my mother believes that girls who read too much are unladylike and ugly, so my father's books are locked in a clear glass cabinet. I gaze at enticing covers and mysterious titles, but I am rarely permitted to touch the enchantment of words. Poems, stories, plays, all are forbidden. Girls are not supposed to think, but as soon as my eager mind begins to race, free thoughts rush in to replace the trapped ones. I imagine distant times and faraway places, ghosts, vampires, ancient warriors. Fantasy moves into the tangled maze of lonely confusion. Secretly, I open an invisible book in my mind, and I step through its magical door shape into a universe of dangerous villains and breathtaking heroes. Many of the heroes are men and boys, but some are girls, so tall, strong, and clever that they rescue other children from monsters.
So Tula faced a very different problem than a lot of young boys and girls do today. Tula was forbidden. She wasn't given access to books, and books were relatively rare at that time. Now we face a different problem, I think. Books are pretty common. Most people have access to a lot of books, except for very poor kids. And yet there's still an urgency to try to get them to read them. There's other competing forces out there for their attention.
Well, that is one of the great ironies of history, is that throughout history, reading has been such an incredible privilege. And in most societies, only the elite were allowed to read. And in the case of women, even in the mid-20th century, when my mother was a child, the books were often locked in a glass cabinet in her home because there were certain things that only her father was supposed to read, and women and children in particular. The Bible is one of the books that was always locked up in a Catholic home in Cuba as late as the 20th century because only men were supposed to interpret it. Women and children were not considered qualified to interpret it. That is really something that has changed now. Children are free to read and yet might resent being expected to. Perhaps if they read more history or heard more history read to them, poetry being such a wonderful read out loud experience, and a book like this could be kind of reader's theater in a classroom, maybe they would realize what an incredible privilege it is to be allowed to read freely and to write freely.
Mm. Can you tell us a little bit more about Tula? What kind, was she kind of like the Harriet Tubman of Cuba?
Well, she was white, so she wasn't the Harriet Tubman, but writing about slavery was prohibited under the Spanish rule.
Mm.
So she wrote at great risk to herself. She wrote an abolitionist romance novel, which was published quite a few years before any abolitionist novels were published in the U.S.
Hmm.
This was really a very daring act to write not just about abolition, but about marriage equality, because it wasn't just an issue of setting slaves free, but she was saying that they should be free to intermarry because everybody was equal. And so by writing an interracial romance novel, she broke more than one taboo.
That's wild. This is early 19th century, or early to mid-19th century, right?
Yes. And at the time, girls in Cuba had, in the upper classes or middle upper classes, such as she was, had arranged marriages. And the marriageable age was 14. She actually defied her family's arranged marriages for herself twice and was punished by being exiled to the countryside. And it's thought that the people in her interracial romance novel came through her experience when she was on a plantation.
Well, if listeners are interested, they can find out a lot more about Tula in your book, The Lightning Dream, Cuba's Greatest Abolitionist. It sounds like a great story that we should know. You mentioned your mother came from Cuba, but it's a little bit more complex, your heritage, than that. And as a way of getting into it, can we hear you read your poem, Kinship?
Yes, Kinship. Two sets of family stories, one long and detailed about many centuries of island ancestors, all living on the same tropical farm. The other side of the family tells stories that are brief and vague about violence in the Ukraine, which Dad's parents had to flee forever, leaving all their loved ones behind. They don't even know if anyone survived. When Mommy tells her flowery tales of Cuba, she fills the twining words with relatives. But when I ask my Ukrainian Jewish American grandma about her childhood in a village near snowy Kiev, all she reveals is a single memory of ice skating on a frozen pond. Apparently, the length of a grown-up's growing-up story is determined by the difference between immigration and escape.
That is unfortunately a very topical poem for our moment today. There's a lot of immigration and escape going on in the world right now. So you have a complicated family story. Your mother's family came from Cuba. Your mother herself came from Cuba. And on your father's side, your father was an American born, but whose family was basically drummed out of the Ukraine because they were Jewish.
Yes, and they came much earlier. His family came in the early 20th century, escaping pogroms.
So your mother came over, I think, in the 1950s, am I right?
My mother came in the late 1940s, and she came to the U.S. to marry my father, who she met when he was traveling in Cuba as an artist painting. So she came for love, not as a refugee. And yet she became an exile after the fact when travel was prohibited. So I inherited that sense of exile. And exiles have a great deal of nostalgia and tell long stories and listen to long stories that are filled with love of the home country. Whereas I think that refugees who have escaped often never look back.
Mm-hmm. Now, before your mother couldn't go back to Cuba, you were born, and you had a chance before the Cuban embargo, I guess, to visit as a young child. Am I right?
Yes. Throughout the 1950s and up as late as 1960, we did spend summers in Cuba.
And these visits and your attachment to Cuba seems to have had a dramatic effect on you and your writing.
Yes, until I was able to start returning to Cuba as an adult, I felt like I had unfinished stories that I would never be able to tell completely. Childhood memories formed a basis for many of my stories, but they were often kind of incomplete, whereas when I could go back and meet many of the same relatives again later in life and see the same places and go through a kind of experience of forgiving history. For me, that was very important, kind of peacemaking experience within myself. I'm not saying that I approve of all the actions of history from either side, but making peace with them within my own mind was very important for me to be able to write about it.
Can I get you to read your poem, Ritmo Rhythm? It's also from your book of verse memoir, Enchanted Air. And it starts with a girl with the funny name of Mad.
Yes, my older sister is Madeline. Yeah. And so Mad was my nickname for her. This poem, Ritmo Rhythm. Mad has decided to catch a vulture, the biggest bird she can find. She is so determined and so inventive that by stringing together a rickety trap of ropes and sticks, she creates a puzzling structure that just might be clever enough to trick a buzzard once the trap's baited with leftover pork from supper. Mad and I used to do everything together, but now I need a project all my own, so I roam the green fields finding bones. The skull of a wild boar, the jawbone of a mule. Older cousins show me how to shake the mule's quijada to make the blunt teeth rattle. Guitars, drums, gourds, sticks, a cowbell, a washboard. Pretty soon we have a whole orchestra. On Cuban farms, even death can turn into music.
That's a wonderful last line. On Cuban farms, even death can turn into music. It's high praise for the vitality of Cuban music. This feels a bit like a recovered memory poem. This is, takes place in your youth. You were a young girl, apparently, in Cuba with your sister. Was this one of the poems that you kind of recovered as an adult going back and visiting?
Well, this one I really sort of carried around with me for a long time because it was such an odd thing for my sister to want to catch a vulture. And,
yes.
You know, when we get together now, she'll laugh about it. Like,
right.
what was she thinking? She had no idea what she would have done with it if she'd caught it. But we had caught tarantulas and scorpions and all sorts of things at that point. We refused to stay indoors. We loved animals. Our school year was spent in Los Angeles in the big city. And when we had the chance to be on a farm in Cuba, we wanted to be outdoors. So it was a very strange thing to want to catch a vulture. And it was strange for me I really wanted horses. That was all I wanted, was to ride horses in Cuba. This particular poem doesn't talk about that.
Hmm.
But we were strange girls from the point of view of a Cuban who would have expected the girls to be indoors helping to cook and clean and embroider and make lace and take care of the babies. That was what the other girls were doing.
Mm.
And we weren't doing what the other girls were doing. We weren't doing what was expected of us. We were outside with the boy cousins.
Uh-huh. So you don't write exclusively about Cuba. I don't want to give anybody the impression. You have a whole range of books that you've written, and you've got a whole book called Silver People, Voices from the Panama Canal. Without explaining what that book's about, can I get you to read The Life of a Digger, Henry from the Island of Jamaica?
The Life of a Digger, Henry from the Island of Jamaica. Jamaican digging crews have to sleep 80 men to a room in huge warehouses like the ones where big wooden crates of dynamite are stored. My hands feel like scorpion claws clamped onto a hard, hard shovel all day, then curled into fists at night. At dawn, the steaming labor trains deliver us by the thousands down into that snake pit where we dig until my muscles feel as weak as water and my backbone is like shattered glass. But only half the day is over. At lunchtime, we see sunburned American engineers and foremen eating at tables in shady tents with the flaps left open, so that we have to watch how they sit on nice chairs looking restful. We also watch the medium-dark Spanish men relaxing as they sit on their train tracks, grinning as if they know secrets. We have no place to sit, not even a stool. So we stand, plates in hand, uncomfortable and undignified. Back home, I used to dream of saving enough Panama money to buy a bit of good farmland for Mama and my little brothers and sisters so that we would all have plenty to eat. Now all I want is a chair and food with some spice and fair treatment, justice.
So this poem and the whole book is about the building of the Panama Canal, but similar conditions, it occurs to me, listening to you, similar conditions apply today. We have millions of workers, some in the country are undocumented, doing a lot of labor all over the country in every corner, largely unseen and unremarked upon. Was that in the back of your mind as you wrote this book?
It actually wasn't, but now that you mention it, it does fit because there was a very clear color line in the digging of the Panama Canal. Under U.S. rule, Americans and Northern Europeans were paid in gold. Southern Europeans and imported Caribbean islanders, who were mostly African Caribbean, were paid in silver. The amount of silver was measured by skin color, so that Southern Europeans received more silver than African Caribbeans. It was such a clear case of racism that I was really inspired for this particular poem by photographs where I saw the lunch facilities for white Americans and Northern Europeans, then saw the Spanish laborers sitting on train tracks, moderately comfortable, at least they were dry on the train tracks, and the Jamaicans and Barbadians standing in mud, eating their food, standing up. And it was just such a clear distinction that I wanted to write in the voice of a Jamaican. And then I also wrote other poems in the voices of these other groups of people.
Mm-hmm. So you're about to launch on a 2-year stint as Young People's Poet Laureate. What's your plan? How do you plan to convince more younger people to take an interest in poetry?
Well, this is just such an amazing opportunity for me. I'm sort of dazed. I'm entranced. I can't believe that I have this opportunity. Huh. I would like to tell young people not to listen to the adults who go around saying that they don't get poetry.
Hmm.
I don't know why so many adults are afraid of poetry. I suspect that it's because poetry asks us to slow down and listen and feel with all our senses. And that's not something that's done a lot in the 21st century. People are rushing around multitasking, being proud of multitasking. I don't think you can multitask and read or write poetry. I think you have to set everything aside and focus on that one page at a time and really experience it with all your five senses and maybe some extra senses that we can't name.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry is not hard to understand. Music is not hard to understand. We don't need to analyze it. Adults, unfortunately, including a lot of teachers and librarians, will say, oh, I don't understand poetry. Well, you listen to music. You don't have to be able to analyze it to listen to it and enjoy it. And I would just say the same for poetry. Just listen, enjoy it, write it, and enjoy it. You don't have to analyze what you write either. I don't think that teaching a lot of rules for how to read a poem is an ideal approach for children. I think children will not be afraid of poetry if they're allowed to approach it as a complete experience, the way they do everything else.
Margarita Engel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Margarita Engel is the new Young People's Poet Laureate. You can find out more about her and read a sampling of her poems on our website. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can link to the podcast on social media from SoundCloud, and you can subscribe to it on iTunes. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.